From the Watson Institute at Brown University, this is Trending Globally. I'm Sarah Baldwin. In high school, Charlotte Silverman worked with Action India, a women's rights organization based in Delhi. One of its fundraising campaigns helped women in a small village in India obtain a machine that makes affordable menstrual pads. Inspired by this campaign, Charlotte and some classmates decided to spearhead production of a documentary about it. The film would show how that machine empowered the women and girls of the village. Charlotte hoped it would be shown in classrooms and health centers. It was. It also won an Oscar. The film's called Period, End of Sentence, and it's available on Netflix. Charlotte's now a rising sophomore at Brown. On this episode, I spoke with her and with Sarah Tucker and Carly Paul, two development studies concentrators who are doing fascinating work on gender and development. We talked about the power and success of Charlotte's film and about how to better frame issues of gender equality and public health around the world. We started by talking about the surprising origins of Charlotte's film.
So I was already involved before this project with a partnership with Action India. And Action India is a local women's rights organization based in Delhi that works with a lot of villages outside of Delhi. And so we had had this kind of ongoing relationship through an organization called Girls Learn International. So we were partnered basically with our girls' rights and women's rights group at my high school, and then with one of their girls' groups there. So we had been doing kind of Skype calls, and like we would read books together. And soon after I started in that club, a couple of girls in my group went to the United Nations, to the Commission on the Status of Women. And that's where we first heard about the machine, about the pad machine. So that's where a lot of people, I mean, there are people from all over the world that come to that conference and basically talk about what's affecting their communities. And menstrual access to menstrual products was a big one that year. That was something that we hadn't really heard about, and like from, I guess, our own research. And it was shocking to all of us. So we started doing local pad drives and tampon drives for women's shelters and youth shelters and things like that. But we also started talking to Action India about like how this could be a bigger project, and how menstrual health like affected their own communities and the villages that they worked with and the women that they worked with.
Well, I'm going to guess that in LA, when you were doing pad drives, it was a question of affordability mm-hmm. or access. It wasn't so much a taboo, I hope.
Right.
But in India, it was really a question of both, right?
Yeah.
Access and taboo.
Yeah. So I think in LA, there are definitely communities where it was taboo, and we definitely noticed it's still not something that anybody would feel comfortable talking about. This project has definitely changed that at my high school. But in general, like that's something that we wanted to break down everywhere, but definitely it was more extreme with the group that we were working with. And so we decided that we wanted to go through with a project that would install one of these pad machines that would kind of work to break down these taboos. But again, like Action India had contact with, the first unit is placed in Kathakara, which is like 3 hours outside of Delhi. And they had sort of identified about 9 women that were really dedicated to this idea, that wanted to work on the machine, that wanted to do door-to-door business sales and like really get something running.
Well, let's just break that down for 1 second. So Mr. Mariganatham, how did he end up making this machine? Why did he care about this when menstruation is such a taboo in India?
Yeah.
Here's this guy. Tell the story about the machine and how it's like a whole microeconomy that gets born.
Mm-hmm. So he basically started this machine because he noticed his wife was kind of hiding her, like once a month hiding this, whatever it was that was happening to her, that she had no idea what was happening to her, that she was using really unsanitary products. And he wanted to combat that in some way. He's known in India as the Pad Man. He has like a Bollywood film after him. Yeah. I would say, though, that one thing we've tried to get across in a lot of ways is that the microeconomy is not really a part of his mission. That's entirely Action India and like the women that decided themselves they wanted to have this be like a fully woman-run system. We're actually not using his machine going forward. We're using a semi-automatic one, and hoping to do more, having more women employed as business strategists and working on that end rather than the actual manual labor.
So it's more about women as business people than it is about women as labor in a way. Is that
exactly.
That's intentional?
Yeah.
Oh, that's interesting.
And I mean, all of this, all of these steps and like moving away from that machine and kind of who's working on the machine, where they buy it, all of that is decided by the women that are employed by Action India and that are, yeah, on the grounds doing the work. So we obviously are here as supporters in whatever way we can be, but it's not our project or decision to, you know, install something or change something that doesn't, that nobody else wants changed.
Well, how did the idea to make a film about this come about?
So that was definitely a long conversation at the beginning when we, before we started our Kickstarter campaign. We were deciding between, we could, you know, purchase three machines or something for villages nearby, or we can make this film. And we thought that, I'm sure this is also a product of being in Los Angeles, but we thought film was a really powerful way to reach a mass audience and to educate people about this issue that was affecting this really specific community and also something that was affecting people around the world. So we thought by making a film, we would, one, spread awareness and also hopefully inspire people to get involved with this work and breaking down taboos and also kind of working with on the ground activists and projecting those stories that are not really told in our general film world, I would say.
But you went from having this idea to actually making a 26-minute documentary.
Yeah.
How did you assemble the team and did you all go?
Yeah, and it was a long process.
Did you ever dream that it would win an Academy Award?
No, when we were talking about making a film, we thought it would be an educational tool and we would try and get high schools and colleges to maybe screen it. And that was kind of our goal. We've gotten there, which is great. But yeah, I guess, how did we start it? We like reached out to every single person that could help us in some way with like directing or editing or festivals and how to go about entering festivals. And because we were pretty clueless as high schoolers. But the team has gone, I mean, there are the founders of the organization and there's like an extended group of like 100 people that have done different parts of the project, and it wouldn't have worked without all of that. So.
And as executive producer, what was your role?
So basically the six of us that co-founded the organization ended up being executive producers, which basically just means we were overlooking the whole process. So I didn't have any like cinematic control or anything like that. But I was basically, we were the ones that were talking about like what the film should look like, who it's going to portray, if it should be about this partnership, if it should be about like the greater issue, or if it should be something really specific. I think we all ended up thinking like it didn't seem right to have us in it. One, that it should be more in the control of Action India and the people that were being portrayed, what the message is. So kind of like making sure that the message is constantly evolving based on the community and not our own views and thoughts about it. And then during production, I guess, was also just maintaining like that contact with Action India. So our director was doing all the cinematic choices and like gathering the footage. And then we were kind of overlooking those more like behind the scenes.
Keeping the project
issues.
Moving.
Yeah. 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 And then I guess afterwards it was like the editing process doing a similar thing, and then entering film festivals, doing panels and interviews and all that.
You entered a lot. How many film festivals did you enter?
I could not even tell you.
Like a couple dozen?
More, yeah. Entered, I think we showed at probably, 12 or something. So
it's amazing.
Yeah, it was a fun year.
Well, Charlotte, you're a gender and sexuality studies concentrator here at Brown. And Sarah Campbell and Carly, you are development studies, both of you. How do you overlap?
I think that Sarah Campbell and I were kind of invited into this conversation because development studies, while a small concentration, is a really, really broad concentration, and people have a lot of very different interests and the ability to really bend their concentration towards those interests. And so she and I are both writing like capstone projects on, with like kind of a gender lens and a gender focus. And so I think that that was what brought us into this conversation.
And what are your respective thesis topics?
So my capstone is on the ways in which women in government don't necessarily translate to experience gender equality in countries. So I look compared to countries that had really high numbers of women in government that was well above the global average, but then tried to look at what the private sphere experience of gender equality meant. So for that, it was like the way women experienced violence in households or between one-on-one relationships with people. So a lot of my distinction, I think how it relates to the idea of like menstrual taboo and just trying to talk about menstruation more, is this distinction between public and private sphere experiences for women. So in a public way, countries can have gender quota laws and they can purport to include women in economics and all these decision-making things, but sort of behind closed doors, it's a different conversation. And a lot of what I've found is that the private sphere is where violence against women plays out, and in the places where sort of more entrenched patriarchal norms play out. And I think you could place talking about menstruation in the private sphere, something that doesn't get discussed, and like what you're doing, trying to make it visible, really opens a lot of doors for a greater discussion about what gender equality actually means for people to experience on a day-to-day basis, rather than just the sort of visible idea of like who's in power is being representative of what people actually experience.
And what two countries did you compare?
I compared Ethiopia and Argentina.
Why?
Great question. So I was looking, to be perfectly honest, I was just like looking at this ranking of women in government, because like that's sort of the go-to conversation, I think, now of like, okay, how many women are in X position of power? And they both have, so both of them are at 38%. The global average is around 26%. So they're notably above the global average, but they're not outliers. So there's some countries that are at like 50% for various reasons. Like Rwanda, for example, is at 50%, but that's partially because a lot of men died during the genocide. So they're sort of comfortably high, but not outliers. And then I really liked the fact that they were very different countries. I thought it was good to have a comparison of two very different geographically and economically different places to illustrate the fact that the private sphere idea is not an anomaly, but more of a trend across countries.
And what made you interested in that topic in the first place? Or when did you notice that there was this discrepancy between representation and what was happening to women in their private lives?
I'm not sure. I think that perhaps similar to Carly, my theme for DS came a little later in my process. So I've always been interested in ideas of equality and feminism, but I think like many people, like, the politics has played a large role, I think, in my college life because just the time that we're in college. And that sort of forced me to start thinking about the way women in politics are treated. And that's always been sort of an important point for me to think about. But then I wanted to think, once women are in power, what does that mean for change? Because I always have talked about, like, I think it's important to have representation. But if it doesn't actually do anything, like, what is the barrier to that? And, like, why is it not doing something? Because I don't think it's a bad thing. But there's got to be some outcome there for it to be meaningful.
That's a great point. And Carly, what is your topic?
Yeah, so mine also kind of aligns with this like idea of stigma and who is represented and who is heard. And I'm writing about PTSD and thinking about how the category of PTSD and its origins are very like related to American military figures, pretty much. And the goal of my capstone is to kind of break down the way in which the PTSD diagnosis was created and think about its like political and social and like international connotations and the way in which it is supposed to be this kind of like diagnosis that can provide restorative justice to people. But it doesn't actually expand its like justice creation to the people that we impart trauma on around the world. And so I'm looking specifically at like women, civilian women in Afghanistan, and how this, like the way that we understand and diagnose PTSD, if it like is useful or has restorative potential for these women and thinking about the ways in which they're like actively excluded from that category and that diagnosis.
Wow, I had not thought of that. That PTSD.
I had it before she talked about it either.
Like, wow, that's a big gap in our brains that we hadn't thought of, that it's for everyone. Yeah.
Well, and it's really, really interesting because I've thought a lot about the way in which like diagnosis is like really interesting and really important in a lot of ways, but also leads to this sort of like medicalization of everything. And I think especially in an era of like Me Too and like seeing that being so present like on our campus and in our lives, and watching like Dr. Ford go and give this testimony and so much of it being rooted around like these provable statements or things like that, I think that that might have been part of the reason that I started thinking about this so much, and the way in which I think in DS and in like more of an anthropological and social based concentration, we're kind of taught to like take people's experiences as fact and like understand those things as like important and real and valuable. And especially like from the feminist sort of classes that I've taken too, that is like totally a pillar of feminism. And I think that for me was a really hard conflict with the way that public health kind of work occurs, and that is so much rooted in, you know, what are these measures we can create and prove and kind of determine. And I find myself reading those papers and being like, but they said that it was like painful and terrible and obvious, like obviously it is. And so I think it's really interesting to think about these categories that we have and how useful they are at the end of the day, or who they're useful for and who they include. Yeah.
So I'm curious about how you talk about PTSD relates to what you were saying about the anecdote of the man who created the machine. Like you were saying his wife was sort of in this like state of distress. So you think there's trauma associated with not knowing about periods and then like experiencing one, not like having an outlet to discuss with other people. Like I think there's an overlap between the way you talk about PTSD and then the lack of conversation about periods can create trauma for people as well.
Yeah. I mean, I wish I had like a way to fully understand that, because honestly I don't. And I think that's the biggest, like that was the biggest shock for me, is imagining being a girl that was my age, like experiencing a period for the first time, thinking the absolute worst because she had absolutely no education as to.
Can I just say some of the heartbreaking quotes from the film when girls were asked in this village,
please,
what was happening to them? One elder woman said, it's something only God knows why. Another girl said, it's an illness. Another said, it's a girl's problem. And when they went to the temple, when they were menstruating, their prayers were believed not to be heard. It's amazing the power of taboo to keep people in a sort of ignorance that is harmful. That's a great question. About trauma and ignorance, I guess. Ignorance being the not knowing, literal not knowing, not a judgment.
Yeah, so I was a part of GlobeMed at Brown for a long time, and GlobeMed is like a national organization that pairs college campuses with grassroots nonprofits around the world, and Brown has been paired with a group in Nairobi, Kenya called UTENA for about probably 9 years now. They're basically an arts organization that wanted to bring more arts and like awareness through arts to their community, which is a slum in Nairobi. And we helped them start a like women's mentorship program that is focused on reproductive health and like financial literacy. But definitely the part that is more developed is the sort of mentorship on reproductive health. And this kind of relates to your question. And I had the chance to go to Kenya. People go to Kenya every summer to work with our partner organization and do kind of monitoring and evaluation of how the program is running. And we attended some of the sessions where the girls are learning about like different reproductive health issues and diseases and, you know, safety and how to, yeah, all of those things. And it really was, you know, a shock to me. And we also got to tour like the clinic that is alongside this community center where these trainings occur. And we went through and helped them edit their manual that they teach from. And it just makes you think about like how terrible health class is in elementary school or junior high, but also the fact that it's like this amazing blessing that we have. And I know that my sex education was fairly liberal, and like that doesn't even exist in some areas of the United States. So yeah, it was definitely shocking to me to be speaking to these girls who, you know, are facing the same sort of like inability to get an education because of what's going on with them, or they have really, really high pregnancy rates and all kinds of overlapping problems. And another one that was really huge for me was seeing like the fact that they talk about birth control, but there are so like limited options of what types of birth control that they have access to. And so it's kind of like, here you can get this like really invasive feeling kind of bar put into your body, like when you don't really even have a basic understanding of your own like reproductive organs. And that is like, seems so simple, but in reality is like absolutely not. And it like seems so simple to say, here's this pad, like it'll fix everything. But at the same time, if you don't have that like foundational understanding, it's those things are completely foreign.
Does the PAD project come with sex ed, for lack of a better word?
So basically the way that like Action India does all the work currently is they have like youth programs where they'll go and do sex education, menstrual health education, and basically they individualize it based on what the community is asking for and what people are needing. But their work is kind of specifically with groups. So it's like with girls that attend their groups. We're hoping that with the spread of the PAD project and the awareness that the film has brought in a lot of areas that they work with, that that more schools will like adopt the, well, one, that more schools will actually purchase fly pads and use them and provide them for free or really low cost within the schools.
Fly is the brand.
Fly is the brand they started. And also that they'll then like give more of an education about what pads are. That's also something that, just to make this connection, the mayor of Providence is in the process of implementing free pads in schools in Providence. And a lot of the research they did actually showed that girls here also will leave school a lot of the time if they have their period, if there's a lot of cultural taboo in areas around Providence, and where people like don't know what's happening to them and then don't have access to them, and that the sex education here is not actually as progressive as we would think it is. So there's a lot of work to be done locally too, and I think that's one thing that we're working on in the PAD project, is making these like global networks of activists and not seeing it as us and them, but really connecting the whole
problem. That's great.
Problem.
I wonder also if it has benefited men and boys as well, if they are breathing easier as well, or if it's given them more of a sense of solidarity or connection or something to these girls, now that they can name what's happening and see that it's just perfectly natural.
I mean, I think there's still a ton of work to be done, so it's hard to speak to like the lifting of the taboo entirely, but I think I only really know what from like my coworker Ajaya, who I talk to most of the time, but she's sort of expressed like the changes within the communities they work with specifically. So I guess that's all I can really speak to. But I think when I was there, the film hadn't been released yet. And I'd known all of the hardships that they had faced before anything had been done when they were implementing the machine. You see that a lot of the men in the village didn't know what it was. They just tried to keep them in the dark about it.
Thought it was to make diapers.
Yeah, exactly. So people have definitely gained a sense of pride from the machine, have been like, this is our one like a claim to fame, but also just like, this is something that so many people in our community are working on and are a part of, that like it's something that they're proud of. And I think that's kind of like one of the biggest changes, is it's not just accepting something, but it's actually feeling a sense of pride in it. And that's a huge change. And I don't know what how everybody, you know, feels about it or how it's changed other communities. I do know that since we've released the film and people have seen it, we get Facebook messages on our organization every day that say, like, this is my exact story. I'm so glad it's out there. I'm so glad people know about this problem. And to hear that, I guess, always makes me like reminds me that there are like there are so many people that this relates to, and that hopefully this brings them also some sort of inspiration or hope that, yeah, things are changing.
I really love the whole thing across the board, and I think that the testimony from all the different people, you got to see the different perspectives, but I loved one of the moments where no one was speaking, actually, when the two women are kind of bundling either hay or something, and they, yeah, you liked it too, and they like have their heads together, and they're like, they have their heads pressing against one another, and they're like leaning down and they're tightening this bundle. And I just thought it was this really, really like beautiful image and metaphor for, you know, women putting their heads together and like accomplishing something really impressive. And I think that image was like encompasses so much of what I think is important and amazing about like women's work and women's issues. And, yeah, I thought that was gorgeous.
That was a beautiful scene. Yeah. That was like if you had to sort of illustrate collaboration and mm-hmm. working together, that was it.
And strength. I love
the
strength.
Things that they put on that girl's head.
Yeah.
And she walks away. It was amazing.
What I think is really impressive, Charlotte, about the way that you talk about the organization is this incredible awareness of not wanting to be an imposition in other places. Like, having talked to you about this multiple times, you always reference the importance of having a connection somewhere before you actually try to talk about the PAD project with them, and making sure that it's not just like a bunch of people from the U.S. coming in with this idea, but something that's actually like socially salient there and like from the ground up. And I just think that's really important to highlight, because it's a model that's been successful, one, and two, is like respectful. Because I think a lot of times we try to impose these ideas of what empowerment means on other communities, and like that's not the way to go about it, and that's very presumptuous. But I feel like the whole premise of the way that y'all have gone about it has been like always centering the people who are affected and like making that decision maker. So I think that's really cool to highlight as well.
Hear, hear.
Was the movie shown in India as well?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So Netflix, the idea was to get a platform that was accessible to the most people. It's not as big there as it is here, which is, you know, it is what it is. Yeah. But we were, we're also like one of our big goals again is to make it an educational tool. So we try and any school that reaches out, mm-hmm. like we try and make it as accessible as possible or send them a DVD or something. But yeah, we first showed it at the UN last year at the Commission on the Status of Women. And then from there, I went to India to show it to the people who are in it, and then to Action India and to a couple of their youth groups. So those are the only places that like I was there for the showing. But yeah, it's being now it's kind of in a process of like a couple of the representatives at Action India brought it to like legislators and are kind of showing it on in a. Yeah.
And that's awesome.
Yeah, so it's sort really of cool. creeping toward policy in a way.
Yeah, that's the goal. Yeah. Because we really were trying to get the free pads in schools again there. So that's like one big.
That would be a victory.
Piece of work. Yeah.
That's amazing.
I mean, we need it here too. But yeah. So.
Well, it sounds like that's also
yeah.
starting to
yeah.
happen.
I mean, there are so many ends of it. The tampon tax, there's like, yeah, we have plenty of work to do.
Well, this has been so much fun and so interesting, and I feel so lucky to have met all of you. Thank you for talking to Trending Globally.
Thank you so much.
Keep up the good work. This episode of Trending Globally was produced by Dan Richards. Our theme music is by Henry Bloomfield. I'm Sarah Baldwin. You can subscribe to us on iTunes, Stitcher, or your favorite podcast app. If you like what you hear, leave us a rating and review on iTunes. It really helps others find the show. For more information about this and other shows, go to watson.brown.edu. Thanks for listening, and tune in 2 weeks for another episode of Trending Globally.